Chapter 19 Operation Lovestorm. George H.W. Bush had been out of the White House for less than 3 months when, in April 1993, he traveled to Kuwait on an official visit. He was there to receive the Mubarak the Great Medal, the nation's highest civilian award for having pushed the Persian Gulf War Resolution of 1991 through Congress, authorizing the use of U.S. military force against Iraq, then occupying Kuwait. The result had been Operation Desert Storm. It was a lavish celebration, resplendent with swordsmen, drummers, and hundreds of cheering children waving flags. The Kuwaiti press called the three-day affair Operation Lovestorm. The Emir of Kuwait, Sheikh Jaber Al-Ahmad Al-Sabah, thanked the former president for the 541,000 U.S. military personnel who'd helped free Kuwait the year before. "This award is in gratitude and appreciation for your enormous efforts in liberating Kuwait and your services toward world peace," said the Emir. George H.W. Bush responded in kind. "Mere words cannot express how proud I feel to be here with you on the hallowed ground of Kuwait," he said. The Emir then knighted the former president and presented him with the Mubarak the Great Medal, named for Kuwait's founder, who famously assassinated two of his half-brothers, political rivals, to ascend the throne. All went well during the festivities. The Emir neglected to mention to any U.S. official that a team of 16 assassins had tried to assassinate former President Bush with a powerful car bomb. Not for another 2 weeks would the Clinton White House learn about the alleged plot. Richard Clark, special assistant to the president, later wrote that he was the first person to hear about it. "I was reading headlines from an Arab language newspaper," says Clark, "when I saw a subject line that grabbed my eye. Ash-Shark al-Azwat was reporting that a band of Iraqi assassins had tried to kill Bush when he was in Kuwait. There had been no such report from the Secret Service, FBI, CIA, or the embassy," Clark insists. Alarmed by this news, Clark telephoned the U.S. ambassador in Kuwait, Ryan Crocker. "Did Crocker know anything about an attempted assassination of former President Bush?" Clark asked. "Had he seen the article in Ash-Shark al-Aswat?" The ambassador said no, that this near attack was news to him. Clark then called Anthony Lake, President Clinton's national security advisor. "Saddam tried to kill Bush," he said. "The next morning, there was a sealed envelope on my desk," remembers Clark, "a message so sensitive that it could not be sent to me electronically from the Situation Room." Clark learned that 16 men accused of being the assassins were presently being held in a Kuwaiti prison. The more the White House staff learned about the plot, the crazier it seemed to get. Two of the prisoners, both Iraqi nationals, had implicated the Iraqi intelligence service, suggesting a conspiracy. Clark advised Anthony Lake to have the State Department put pressure on Kuwait to find out what exactly was going on. Why had the Kuwaitis told a newspaper about the conspiracy before they'd shared information with their friends in the United States? "They have to come clean with us," Clark recalls Lake telling him. The fact that the Clinton White House was just now learning about this assassination attempt made the new president look weak. Ambassador Crocker telephoned Kuwait's Minister of Defense. Details of the plot were not supplied at the time because President Bush was on his way home and the plot had been thwarted, the defense minister said. He told Crocker that the government of Kuwait was moving forward with a trial. The White House demanded immediate access to all the prisoners. Because the attack was against a former U.S. president, the CIA and FBI had to be allowed to conduct their own independent criminal investigations, the White House said. On October 29, 1993, CIA officers from the Counterterrorist Center and FBI agents arrived in Kuwait City to interview suspects and examine evidence. From there, a narrative emerged. The group of assassins and accomplices included 4 Iraqis, 1 Kuwait-born Iraqi national, and 12 stateless Bedouins. The information the CIA found most credible came from the group's ringleader, a former military officer turned nurse, Wali al-Ghazali. The CIA accessed his records and learned he'd been trained to use explosives as a member of Iraq's National Guard. In 1993, he was working at Al-Najaf Hospital outside Basra, he said, when military intelligence service agents, the Mukhbarat, informed him he was being sent on a mission he could not refuse. To assassinate the former President Bush as revenge for the devastation caused by coalition forces during Operation Desert Storm. The Mukhbarat, also known as the Department of General Intelligence, was the most heavy-handed instrument of Iraq's state security system. With its multiple divisions or directorates, the organization was fundamental to Saddam Hussein's preservation of autocratic rule. Like most Iraqi citizens, al-Ghazali knew better than to challenge a request. Fearing retribution against his family, he agreed to take part in the Mukhbarat's assassination operation. Taking advantage of the porous Kuwait-Iraq border, he was told to pose as a whiskey smuggler and infiltrate Kuwait with a car bomb. He was to park the vehicle on a busy Kuwait City street and then detonate the bomb remotely as President Bush's motorcade drove by. The Mukhbarat provided al-Ghazali with a Land Cruiser pre-fitted with explosive devices that had been soldered into the side panels. He was given 2 Browning pistols with suppressors, 2 landmines, 2 hand grenades, an AK-47, a passport from the UAE, a case of contraband whiskey, $1,100 in cash, and a suicide belt. If the car bomb failed to detonate, al-Ghazali was to walk to Kuwait University, get as close to President Bush as possible, and detonate the explosives belt as a fedayeen, or suicide bomber. Directions understood, Wali al-Ghazali set off into the night, accompanied by the stateless Bedouins. The assassins crossed the border into Kuwait and drove the Land Cruiser to a pre-designated rendezvous point in a town called Al-Jara. There, they hid in a goat barn belonging to an uncle of one of the Bedouins. The men drank some of the whiskey they were given and fell asleep. When they awoke, the goat barn was surrounded by Kuwaiti police. Al-Ghazali said that he and 2 others escaped, stole the vehicle, and sped toward Iraq. But their car broke down and they were forced to abandon it on the side of the road. As they walked into the desert, they were spotted by local bird hunters and reported and arrested by a Kuwaiti police patrol. It's impossible to know if the testimony was fabricated through coercion or a genuine account of an actual assassination plot. The declassified findings by the FBI forensics team were equally vague. The car bomb found in Kuwait closely resembles the corresponding components of Iraqi-made bombs that were recovered in February 1991 during Operation Desert Storm, the report indicates, with details redacted. FBI agents warranted that the bomb's fusing system, faceplates, and radio-controlled receiving devices, as well as the type of circuit boards used, gave agents what they felt was a recognizable signature to a known Iraqi bomb maker affiliated with the Mukhbarat. The wires ran under the on-off switch and were soldered into the circuit board in a uniquely expert way, proving that the same person was responsible. After pages rife with redactions, the FBI forensics team reached a conclusion. Examination of other components used in the explosive devices recovered in Kuwait, together with a comparison of the techniques used to assemble them, once again provided ample proof of direct Iraqi responsibility. Ample proof is hardly the same as beyond a reasonable doubt, but the trial was being held in Kuwait, not the United States. CIA officers with the CTC included Saddam Hussein's long history of assassinations and summary executions in its report for President Clinton. Since assuming power in the late 1970s, Saddam Hussein had ordered the killings of political rivals and people he felt had betrayed him. Religious clerics, Kurdish Peshmerga leaders, and scientists who attempted to defect had been shot, strangled, and blown up by the Mukhbarat. After the Gulf War, Saddam Hussein became more emboldened with his plots, CTC officers wrote, exemplified in an assassination attempt against Danielle Mitterrand, the wife of the French president, 9 months before. On July 6, 1992, Mrs. Mitterrand was traveling in a diplomatic convoy through the town of Sulaymaniyya in northern Iraq when a parked Toyota Land Cruiser exploded into a 60-foot-high fireball. She escaped injury, but 4 members of her security detail were killed and 19 others wounded, mostly people who'd gathered to wave as she passed by. This brazen attack, wrote the CIA, demonstrated Saddam Hussein's willingness to disregard international opinion and possible military retaliation. There were other warning signs, wrote CTC analysts, including Ba'ath Party threats against President Bush. Shortly before the plot unfolded, Iraqi government officials hinted at a forthcoming attack. Bush will be killed based on a universal judicial system, Saddam's press secretary told a reporter for Al-Thawa, one that goes beyond the law of the jungle. Another Ba'ath Party official promised, this president will be cursed along with his ancestors until the day of judgment, that he and others would be hunted down and punished, held personally responsible for each drop of blood spilled on Iraqi soil. What to do? President Clinton called his advisors into the Oval Office. Secretary of State Warren Christopher said, a plot to kill a former president is an attack against our nation. President Clinton agreed. He ordered the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the CIA to develop a target list. The targets would include the headquarters building of the Mukhbarat. The strike should occur at night, the Joint Chiefs of Staff said, to minimize casualties. Colin Powell suggested cruise missiles launched from a destroyer in the Red Sea. On June 26, 1993, 23 Tomahawk cruise missiles were launched at Baghdad, leveling much of the Iraqi intelligence headquarters and killing a night watchman. 3 of the missiles missed their targets and exploded in a nearby residential neighborhood, killing 8 civilians. Among the dead were the director of the Saddam Hussein Center for the Arts, a painter named Laila Al-Attar, her husband and their housekeeper. The couple's son and daughter were both seriously injured. Al-Attar was reportedly a close friend of Saddam's. Her home had been hit by a missile in the Persian Gulf War, and she had suffered a serious wound to her leg. Now she was dead. In a nationally televised speech, President Clinton called the assassination plot against former President Bush particularly loathsome and cowardly and revenge by a tyrant. But the U.S. response was not an attempt to kill Saddam Hussein, he said, rather a means to prevent future attacks. It was 2 days later that the 23 cruise missiles were fired. Madeleine Albright, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, citing Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, said that America was exercising its legal right to self-defense. In Baghdad, anti-American crowds held demonstrations in the streets. "Revenge to America," they chanted. "Shame on America! Glory to the martyrs of Iraq!" They issued a warning to America's new president. "Clinton, pay attention. We are the people who toppled Bush." It was the fall of 1993, and Lou Merletti sat at his desk inside the Treasury building, surrounded by piles of paperwork. He was no longer on the Presidential Protective Division, and on rare occasions would stop to wonder how on earth he'd wound up in a place doing exactly the opposite of what he excelled at. For more than a decade, he had been in the president's inner circle. Now he was being asked to serve as a bureaucrat. "It was the job I was assigned to do, and I accepted that, but it was really depressing," Merletti recalls. He felt like Billy Waugh did when he was working at the post office after Vietnam. Everything had been going so well back in 1992. As the assistant to the special agent in charge of the president during the Gulf War, Merletti had been entrusted with tremendous responsibility. When President Bush and General Schwarzkopf traveled to the Middle East during Operation Desert Storm, Merletti was in charge of their security. Because of his combat experiences as a Green Beret in Vietnam, he felt entirely confident in the role. His missions had all been a success. And now, 20 months later, here he was, sitting at a desk, loaded down by paperwork. Prior to the presidential election of 1992, Merletti was selected by the Secret Service to assume the top position in the Presidential Protective Division, were George H.W. Bush to be reelected. When Bill Clinton won the election instead, Merletti was assigned to the Treasury Department, the organization that governed the U.S. Secret Service. At Treasury, he'd been asked to lead the team investigating what went wrong in Waco, Texas, when federal agents raided the compound of a religious cult suspected of stockpiling illegal weapons, and 76 people died. The fiasco would become known as the Waco Siege. Merletti's official title summed up the labyrinthine world into which he'd been pulled. He was the deputy director of the review team for the report of the Department of the Treasury on the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms investigation of Vernon Wayne Howell, also known as David Koresh. The work was laborious and painstaking. It was not pleasant investigating where fellow civil servants went wrong. Because the investigation was such a high-profile event, as the top law enforcement officer on the team, Merletti was unwittingly shoved into the limelight. When it came time to report the findings to Congress, his situation went from bad to worse. The Treasury Department's top law enforcement officer has told federal firearms administrators that a probe into their February 28 raid uncovered serious errors in agents' judgment, and that some officials had knowingly made misleading statements about the raid to their superiors and to the media, reported the Washington Post. "People lost their jobs," Merletti explains. "Then a very strange thing happened." At the congressional hearing, under oath, A congressman said to me, "I'd like to meet the individual who is in charge of this report," Merletti recalls. The initial tone of the congressman, a fellow Republican, at first led Merletti to believe that he was expressing appreciation for the truth. Most Republicans seemed to want blame laid at the feet of President Clinton, which the Treasury report had determined should not happen. "I wrote the report," Merletti told the congressman. "He looked at me," recalls Merletti, "and his tone switched. He said, 'I just had to meet the person who wrote this pack of lies.'" Merletti was stunned. "So you're a Clinton guy," the congressman said, smirking. In that moment, Merletti understood it was all politics. As a Secret Service agent, Lou Merletti was trained to leave politics out of the job. "The office of the president is what matters," he explains. "There is an institution to uphold. We used to have a sign on the wall in the White House field office that said, 'You elect them, we'll protect them.' We all worked with that concept in mind." That Merletti was no longer on the presidential protective division had nothing to do with politics, he told himself. It had to do with circumstance. He reported the Waco failings he'd discovered because it was the truth, not because he was a Democrat, which he wasn't. Several days later, he received word that President Clinton wanted to see him in the Oval Office. "I went into his office," Merletti recalls, "and I was told to bring a copy of the report. The president gave me a compliment regarding the work. He pointed to the report and asked to autograph it for me." There was a long pause, Merletti recalled. Then the president spoke candidly. He said something to the effect of, "You did a good job up there," meaning on Capitol Hill, and said that he and his staff knew the investigation was going to be politicized, and they were aware that I probably had no idea my testimony was going to be about that. The president was thanking Lou Merletti for being apolitical. The meeting was over, and Merletti went home to his family. Perhaps President Clinton said something to the director of the Secret Service, or to the special agent in charge of the Presidential Protective Division. Or maybe what happened next was circumstantial. Either way, Merletti's life was about to change. On September 12, 1994, 70 miles north of the White House, near Aberdeen, Maryland, an unemployed truck driver named Frank Eugene Corder spent the evening with his brother drinking alcohol and smoking crack cocaine. Around midnight, Corder asked his brother to drop him off near a small airport in Churchville. Once there, Corder somehow managed to scale the fence, drop down onto the tarmac, and steal a Cessna aircraft. High on drugs, he taxied down the runway and took off into the night sky. Corder was not a licensed pilot, but had taken a few Cessna lessons the summer before, apparently learning enough to allow him to fly the stolen craft over Pennsylvania and Maryland for roughly 40 minutes. At 1:06 a.m., FAA radar systems at Baltimore Washington International Airport detected the aircraft and noted that it was 6.5 miles north of the White House, flying at an altitude of 2,700 feet. The plane dropped to 1,000 feet, turned around, and headed south. At 1:48, it entered the prohibited airspace of the White House complex and began descending rapidly. With its wing flaps up and its throttle position in full forward, Corder crashed the Cessna onto the lawn, skidded across the grass, struck a magnolia tree, and slammed into the first floor of the White House, killing himself. President Clinton and his family were across Pennsylvania Avenue at Blair House for the night. It was a calamitous security breach, made worse by an interview the Secret Service gave to Newsweek magazine. National Airport shuts down at 11 p.m., and controllers in the tower were absorbed in other duties, an official spokesman said. When the reporter asked how that was even possible, why the FAA hadn't detected the security breach, the official said, "The FAA isn't really in the business of protecting the president from flying suicides." To which the Newsweek reporter responded, "That leaves the real question, who is?" The entire event was a disaster. To Lou Merletti's eye, presidential protection was contingent on three fundamentals that never changed. The world is a dangerous place. It doesn't matter who's to blame, only that you defend against it. The U.S. Secret Service must never appear weak. An attack could come from anywhere, including a lone wolf, a terrorist organization, or a foreign government. Because Merletti had foreseen this kind of attack from above, the Presidential Protective Division had trained for it during the Delta Force Halo Assassin AOP exercise. He was called to the White House. Secret Service Director L.J.B. Bowron asked him how security could be tightened. These details, like all Secret Service protocols, are classified. Bowron also asked Merletti to come to the Secret Service team room in the White House to talk to the PPD agents about what it meant to protect the president. The speech is classified, but Lou Merletti says he wrote it with his old friend Mike Karopas in mind. Bowron transferred Merletti back to the White House PPD. He would now serve as deputy special agent in charge, which meant he was the number two in charge of the safety and security of the President of the United States. In the middle of October, President Clinton called Lou Merletti into his office to tell him to prepare for travel to Syria, Jordan, Egypt, and Israel. This was one of the most difficult and dangerous parts of the world in which to protect the President of the United States against assassination attempts. Lou Merletti was ready for the job. Chapter 20. Carlos the Jackal. It was Christmas time when Billy Waugh was summoned to his CIA reporting site in Northern Virginia. He was being sent on a top-secret, gamma-classified mission as the senior operator on a 4-person reconnaissance and surveillance team. During the classified briefing, Waugh learned that the target was Ilich Ramirez Sanchez, nom de guerre Carlos the Jackal, the mastermind behind the spectacular 1975 OPEC siege. Unseen for years and believed by many to be dead, he was now hiding out in Khartoum. CIA Chief of Station Kofor Black was determined to get him. The CIA didn't want to kill Carlos the Jackal. They wanted to capture him. For 18 years, he'd been in hiding, able to function out of reach of Interpol, the CIA, the FBI, Mossad, and France's General Directorate for External Security, DGSE. Each had placed a significant bounty on information leading to his arrest. The Jackal moved around the globe as the guest of one state sponsor of terror, official and unofficial, after the next. Libya, Syria, Cuba, Iraq, Hungary, Romania. For the CIA, learning what his quid pro quo was with these countries would help the Counterterrorist Center better understand how the global terrorist network worked, how assassins operated, and who pulled the strings. Carlos the Jackal was a dangerous killer who'd machine gun down people who were after him, Kofor Black explained in 2017. Billy Waugh was the perfect person to conduct a hidden hand operation to capture him. On December 13, 1993, Waugh flew from Dulles Airport to Frankfurt to Khartoum. His diplomatic passport said he worked for the U.S. Department of State. Looking down over Khartoum as he flew in, he observed the White River and the Blue Nile. The dirt streets, the ramshackle houses made of mud and tin, all barely visible through a thick brown haze that hung like a fog. Being in Sudan was like being behind enemy lines, Waugh recalls. It's a non-permissive environment. Every step must be taken with great care. At the airport, he showed his credentials. A Dinka woman examined his passport and marked his travel bags with white chalk, indicating he was a diplomat and could not be searched. Inside the bags were chemicals necessary to develop film. By the time Waugh got to his embassy-owned villa, it was past curfew. He'd been stopped by soldiers called Jundis on the way in and had given them a carton of cigarettes as a bribe. The U.S. sanctions against Sudan had made money even tighter, and everyone was looking for a bribe. At the safe house, Waugh's teammates were waiting up for him. They all had last-name aliases and would use their regular first names, Billy, Greg, Don, Santos. The team talked for hours. First thing in the morning, Waugh acclimated himself to the city by heading out for a jog, the quickest way to reestablish area familiarization. Back at the villa, the team climbed into their Land Cruiser and headed to the U.S. Embassy complex on Abdel Latif Avenue. The pace of the Sudanese intelligence services had picked up since the bin Laden job, Waugh noted. The vehicle they were driving in was almost immediately tailed. A white Toyota pickup truck filled with soldiers carrying AK-47s followed along a few cars back in a signature show of force. The Land Cruiser crossed the railroad bridge and headed into Khartoum City and over to the U.S. Embassy compound. In the parking lot there, the guards, Dinka tribesmen, and Marine Corps commanders kept diligent watch. The team passed through heavy security and traveled up to the third floor, where the CIA station was then located next to the Regional Security Office, the State Department's law enforcement agency responsible for all in-country personnel. They made their way through an entry lock, past the passcode panel, and through several more doors before they were finally inside. Kofor Black led the meeting. Everybody wanted Carlos the Jackal, he said. Mossad wanted him, France wanted him, the FBI wanted him, the CIA was going to get him. But the first part of the equation had been the most difficult to date, identifying who Carlos the Jackal actually was. No one could say for sure, since there had not been a photograph taken of Ilich Ramirez Sanchez in roughly 8 years. In 1985, the Hungarian security services had secretly made a video of him meeting with their chief of security. Looking fat, slovenly, and unshaven, Carlos the Jackal pleaded that he not be forced to leave Hungary. The image was all the team had to go on for now. The Jackal was a heavy drinker and smoker, a partier in declining health. But how to find a single, debauched-looking white man who happened to be a most wanted person in a chaotic, lawless city of over 1 million people? This was the first critical part of the job. Photograph the Jackal to establish proof of life. It was the Jordanian General Intelligence Directorate, GID, Jordan's equivalent of the CIA, that had provided the initial intelligence that indicated the Jackal had moved to Khartoum. Under the pretense of being a Muslim, Ilich Ramirez Sanchez had married a second time, a 26-year-old Jordanian named Lana Abdel Salim Jarar. GID tracked the two of them to Khartoum. Jordanian intelligence provided the CIA with a photograph of Jarar. In Khartoum, the Jackal started making mistakes. It was his lack of discipline that would lead to his downfall, recalls Waugh. His first mistake was getting drunk and starting a fight. He got into an argument with a shopkeeper and pulled a gun on the man, which landed him in jail. Local police do not take kindly to foreigners. He had to call Torabi, President al-Bashir's secretary general, to come get him out. That was only the first mistake, says Waugh. He decided it was time to get himself a foreign bodyguard. That was the fatal move. Carlos the Jackal made an international call to one of his old associates from the days of the Black September terrorist attacks. The Israeli intelligence corps picked up the signals intelligence. The man, believed to be an Iraqi national, went by the alias Tariq. Mossad provided the CIA with the first real break in the case. They had photographs of Tariq, which were sent to the CIA's cartoon station via secure fax. "We all studied the photographs carefully," remembers Waugh. What was unusual about Tariq was that he looked Caucasian with white wavy hair. He was around 40 years old and fit. He had big muscles, like a bodybuilder on steroids. Waugh was assigned the job of photographing Tariq when he arrived at Khartoum International Airport. But Carlos the Jackal had friends in high places. A state-sponsored handler met Tariq before he entered the public area and covertly escorted him away through an airport side door. On January 20, 1994, Waugh and Greg went to the Meridian Hotel on a reconnaissance mission. Carlos the Jackal frequented international hotels, alcohol was served, and it made sense he'd send his new bodyguard to case these places in advance. Disguised as businessmen eating dinner, Waugh and Greg spotted Tariq sitting on a couch in the lobby doing a crossword puzzle. Hotel clerks were known to be on the payroll of the secret police, the political security organization. Hanging out doing surveillance was not an option, so Waugh and Greg finished their dinner, went outside, and sat in their parked vehicle. With a solid view of the front exit, they waited. After some time, Tariq sauntered out. He walked up to a white 1990 Toyota Cressida, license plate 1049, and climbed inside. This was a tremendous lead. Now it was time to follow him. Tariq pulled out of the lot and drove toward the Blue Nile River. He made an immediate U-turn, tradecraft for how to lose a tail. Waugh and Greg followed him for a few blocks, but after a few more U-turns, it was time to drop the surveillance. Back at the CIA station, Waugh and Greg shared their findings with Kofor Black. The search was narrowing in focus, which meant it was gaining momentum, says Waugh. Over the next few weeks, the team divided up, each man spending 16 hours a day searching for the white Cressida, license plate 1049. Each member of the team had a portable radio that was linked back to a comm system at the CIA station. This enabled them to track one another's whereabouts at all times and to communicate with the Khartoum station in real time. Transmissions were encrypted. "Anyone trying to listen in to what we were doing would hear nothing but loud noise, like a howling wind," recalls Waugh. Each man had a specific talent, just as in Special Forces operations. Team member Don, a former police officer, was a rare genius in vehicle searches, says Waugh. He had a remarkable ability to recognize vehicles and identify plates from great distances, almost like a sixth sense. With a list of the places Carlos the Jackal was most likely to visit, they waited and watched. The Meridian Hotel, the Hilton Hotel, and the Diplomatic Club were the three top spots. Every Thursday night, the Diplomatic Club threw a huge party, complete with disco dancing and a full bar. It was located 15 miles outside of the city center. On the first Thursday in February, the Cressida was spotted in the parking lot. Waugh picked up the car as it left the disco and headed north. Traffic was crazy out here in the suburbs, with cars, trucks, and donkey carts all fighting for a space on the dirt road. There were no lights and lots of tall people meandering across the road. He lost the car in no time and headed back to the Khartoum station. The excitement of locating the Cressida wore off, followed by a long period of surveillance. They were back to ground zero, the hunt for the vehicle. After days of searching, excitement gave way to monotony. They searched the city in vain, 18 hours a day. Most of the apartment complexes in Khartoum were surrounded by 10-foot-tall mud walls. Trying to find Tariq felt like searching for a needle in a haystack. When he wasn't out conducting surveillance, Wa practiced his photo-developing skills in the CIA photographic laboratory located in the U.S. Embassy compound on the 6th floor. Developing film in Khartoum was challenging. The water came out of the pipes somewhere around 90 degrees Fahrenheit. To get a proper water bath cooled down to between the requisite 68 to 70 degrees Fahrenheit involved the skillful use of ice cubes. Wa and Greg were inside the film lab when the encrypted radio sprang to life. Don had spotted the Cressida in Khartoum's New Edition neighborhood. It had just pulled up to Ibn Khaldun Hospital on 19th Street. Wa told Don to take up a surveillance position. If the car moved, he said, follow it. Wa and Greg hurried out of the lab, down the embassy's private elevator, and out into the parking lot. The two PSO intelligence officers assigned to tail them had fallen asleep in their pickup truck. Wa and Greg climbed into their Land Cruiser and began driving fast, headed toward the hospital. Wa told Greg to open the lockbox that was welded to the floor, take out the camera, a 35mm Canon F80 with a 300mm lens, and assemble it. 5 minutes later, they were at the hospital. Wa spotted Don's car, drove past it, and pulled his vehicle into a spot 20 meters away from the Cressida. From his back window, he now had a clear shot of Tariq's car. Less than 10 minutes before, we'd been in the lab at the embassy mixing chemicals. Two white men sitting in a car would surely get the attention of the ever-present PSO. Wa told Greg the plan. On the dirt shoulder of the road, there was a vendor selling wares. Greg should go over there and consider buying something, hang out, wait until Carlos the Jackal exited the hospital, then make some kind of a commotion to get attention. Wa got out of the Land Cruiser and opened the hood. Feigning engine trouble, he fiddled around inside. Then, leaving the hood open, he climbed back inside and set up the camera, using the space between the front seat and its headrest as a platform for the long lens. He focused the lens on the hospital exit doors. As I was adjusting the lens, the face of a pretty woman came into focus, he recalls. It was Lana, Carlos's second wife. He quickly snapped four or five pictures he believed were properly focused and framed. As Lana Girard walked toward the Cressida, there was a sudden outburst near where the vendor was selling his wares on the dirt shoulder of the road. "You've cheated me," Greg shouted at the vendor. Agitated like he was willing to fight, Wa watched as the man stood up. He was about 7 feet tall, recalls Wa. He towered over Greg. Greg continued to play the role of the customer who'd been cheated. Wa kept his lens trained on the hospital door. A man emerged. Caucasian in his 40s, well-groomed, with reddish hair, combed back, a mustache, fat, 40 or 50 pounds overweight, recalls Wa. He carried a small weapons bag over one shoulder. I spotted a leg holster near his right ankle. He wore a shooter's vest, sleeveless and with pockets in the front. Behind him, a black African man was carrying a large manila envelope in one hand. following the jackal to his car. Greg continued arguing with the tall Dinka vendor. The situation had escalated to such a degree, recalls Waugh, that it had the attention of the fat man who emerged from the hospital. Click, click, click. Waugh took photographs of Carlos the jackal, one photograph after the next, until he'd used the entire roll of film. Lana Girard climbed into the driver's seat and started the car. Carlos climbed into the passenger seat as the hospital technician set a large manila envelope inside the car on the back seat. X-rays, thought Waugh. There was a quick exchange between Waugh and Greg. Time to close down the operation, Waugh said. Greg pulled a large bill from his wallet and paid the unwitting Dinka vendor for his troubles. It was time to get out of there fast. The Cressida pulled out of its parking spot. Ahead, Waugh watched Don pull out of his spot and follow along. Waugh and Greg headed back to the embassy. We tried getting Kofor Black on the encrypted radio, but he was nowhere to be found. At the embassy, they rushed into the photo lab. It was the most important roll of film I'd handled to date, recalls Waugh. Under the glow of the red light bulb, Waugh worked patiently to get the water bath to the precise temperature. A few degrees off, and he could ruin the film. It was quiet in the lab. The smell of the German photographic chemicals filled his senses. When he was confident the elements were correct, he developed the film. Was this Carlos the Jackal? The pictures were sharp, clear. The target jumps out at you, remembers Waugh, and for a minute, it's like you've already captured him. Right after the film was developed, Don called. He tailed the Cressida to an apartment complex in a residential area where the car was now parked behind a gate. He'd observed the man and the woman walk up a flight of stairs and head inside. It was very likely that this was where Carlos the Jackal lived. Waugh continued developing the film. Waugh and Greg couldn't wait to tell Kofor Black. More than 2 hours had passed, and they still hadn't heard from him. Screw it, thought Waugh. I decided to break protocol and drive to Kofor's house myself. Waugh and Greg drove out of the embassy, down along the Blue Nile River, past the Chinese embassy, past Tarabi's home, past where the aspiring terrorist Osama bin Laden lived. They drove over to the eastern side of the Al Riyadh neighborhood, where Kofor Black resided. We said hello to the guard who rang the bell. Kofor Black emerged in running attire. I'd been exercising in my home, Black recalls. I asked them what in hell they wanted, what was so important it couldn't wait. Billy Waugh handed Kofor Black an envelope containing the photographs. Jesus Christ, Billy, Black recalls telling Waugh, this is Carlos's goddamn wife. Keep looking, Billy said. They moved inside the house, where Black spread the photographs out across his dining room table. Who the hell took these? He asked. Greg said Waugh did. 2 hours before, outside Ibn Khaldun Hospital. Time to get the photos to CIA headquarters in D.C., Kofor Black said. At 2 a.m., a lieutenant colonel with the U.S. Department of State diplomatic staff boarded a Lufthansa flight to Frankfurt, continuing on to Dulles Airport in Virginia. Two CIA officers met the lieutenant colonel at the plane. Kofor sometimes said I took actions without bothering to think of the possible repercussions, which was sometimes true, Waugh recalled in 2017. That's what it means to be an independent contractor, a singleton. You can do the job, get it done, without having the CIA monitor your every move. It involves risk. You can't make a mistake or your bacon gets kicked out. When it pays off big time. The photographs went to the 7th floor at CIA headquarters at Langley. There, two division chiefs gave their opinions. Next, an agency operative flew the pictures back the other way to Amman, where Jordanian intelligence confirmed that this was Ilich Ramirez Sanchez. The CIA wanted to capture him. The paramilitary operators needed to move fast, but not too fast. There were spies everywhere. If the Jackal got wind of the fact that the agency had located him and would now create a plan to capture him, he'd get out of Khartoum fast. Shortly after the Jordanians confirmed the Jackal's identity, a local asset told his handler that Carlos was moving to Cyprus, transiting through Cairo. Waugh and a team were sent to the Africa terminal of Cairo International Airport to conduct surveillance. For 6 days, they watched the terminal. Carlos never showed up. Covert action is not all action. Sometimes you sit around bored out of your mind. A lot of your time is spent running down a bad tip, says Waugh. In March, Kofor Black authorized a team to watch the house that Don had identified. They located a dilapidated 6-story apartment building across the street. The apartment on the top floor had a direct line of sight to Carlos's building. It was perfect. It was a hellhole, recalls Waugh, filthy beyond what you can imagine. Ceilings crumbling down, holes in the wall, no running water, no toilet. But it had a direct view of the entrance and exit, and the Toyota Cressida was parked right out front. Waugh and Santos told the building manager that they were surveyors working for the U.S. government. Sensing money, he asked for $700 a month, recalls Waugh, an exorbitant amount in Sudan, where the average income was about $300 a year. He also asked for 3 months up front. In a place like Sudan, you can't hide the fact that you're American. Some of the money is keep-your-mouth-shut money. He didn't report us to the PSO because he wanted the 4th month's rent. The next challenge was getting the surveillance equipment into the apartment. To avoid drawing attention to themselves, Waugh and Santos worked at night. The camera equipment included several camera bodies and an assortment of lenses and tripods that together weighed several hundred pounds. The lens that was hardest to conceal was a 4,000-millimeter Quasar, 24 inches in diameter and 140 pounds. It was secreted into Khartoum via diplomatic pouch in a case the size of a footlocker. Inside the observation post, OP, they had 2 folding cots, blackout curtains, and a Bunsen burner for boiling water and cooking rice. Creating a fast way out of the OP in the event of a raid by the security police was a key to success as well as peace of mind. If we were caught in the OP, we were told we would almost certainly be shot on sight, says Waugh. So we devised an escape route using rappelling ropes. We located the sturdiest pipes, then rigged up a system with ropes. We left a pair of rappelling gloves in an air vent on the roof. With the OP set up, they began surveillance. For this, Waugh fashioned a large chart on the wall onto which he would document who came and who went and when. Waugh was intrigued by how reckless, pathetic, and debauched Carlos was, and yet how predictable was his routine. He was a drunken partier. He went out, drank, came home, slept, went out again. His security detail were all Arabs. Their style appeared to be modeled after the U.S. Secret Service, says Waugh. They kept perimeter guard around the house. Before a visitor arrived, they'd opened the gate, look around for an ambush, then go back and get Carlos or Lana, then get them into the car. It was the same every day, Waugh says, but one thing they forgot to do was ever look up. They never saw our OP. That was their big mistake. Plans for a capture mission were being drawn up. One day at the embassy, Kofor Black told Billy Waugh that he wanted a shot of the jackal that was really, really close. Billy used the Quaestar lens and took a photograph of Carlos's teeth. "He happened to have a toothpick in his mouth," recalls Waugh. "What the hell is this?" Kofor Black asked when Waugh showed him a photograph that, at first glance, looked more like postmodern art than a surveillance photograph. "It's a toothpick balanced between Carlos the Jackal's teeth," said Waugh. Black chuckled and got back to work. Waugh photographed everyone who visited the Jackal's apartment. "It was a parade of bad guys," Waugh says. "For the counter-terrorist center at Langley, this was an intelligence goldmine." One week, the CIA chief of station in Paris, Richard Holm, visited. Dick Holm was a legend at the CIA. He'd served as a covert action operator in Laos, as had Waugh, although the two men had not worked together. Later, stationed in Congo, Holm had been surveying military targets from a two-seater T-28 when his plane crashed into rebel-held territory. He survived but suffered third-degree burns over 35% of his body. He lived only because he was rescued and taken care of by local Azande tribesmen who dug bugs out of his wounds using a knife and covered him in a homeopathic blue-black paste made of snake oil and tree bark to keep his burns from becoming infected. Another CIA pilot also on that mission that day, a man named Tunon, was captured by a different group of tribesmen, the Simbas, who killed and ate him, according to reports by local missionaries. The Simbas believed that if you eat the flesh and vital organs of your enemy, you gain strength, Holm explained in an oral history. The world of covert action was perilous. It made no sense who lived and who died. Dick Holm had been tracking Carlos the Jackal since the early 1980s. He would now act as the liaison between DGSE and the CIA. The man in the lead on the French side was Philippe Rondon, a special services investigator who'd been tracking the Jackal even longer, back to when the terrorist had killed two French intelligence officers before the OPEC siege. Waugh briefed both men on what he'd seen from the observation post. The two senior officers chose not to share with Waugh details about the snatch-and-grab capture mission they were planning. On August 12, 1994, Waugh watched Carlos the Jackal and Lana Girard leave the house at the usual time. He photographed them exiting, as he always did. Then something unusual happened. They didn't return after the disco closed, as was customary. All night, Waugh waited and watched, then into the following day. He was surprised. Had Carlos the Jackal gotten away? "I got a call from Kofor Black over the encrypted commo. 'Come on in, Billy,' was all he said." Anxious to learn what was happening, Waugh drove fast over to the U.S. Embassy. Pulling into the driveway, he was surprised to see the U.S. Ambassador, Donald Peterson, standing out front. Waugh parked his vehicle and climbed out. Peterson walked toward him, his hand extended. The ambassador said, "Great work, Billy," and as he shook my hand, he said, "Carlos the Jackal has been captured." Inside the CIA station, the staff celebrated with champagne. It was a big day. In the snack bar on the overhead television set, Waugh watched the Air France network present a news broadcast. "The French had captured Carlos the Jackal in Khartoum," an announcer said. The terrorist was on his way to Paris, where he would face justice for a myriad of attacks and crimes. The role of the CIA in this mission remained entirely hidden. For several days, news crews gathered around the apartment complex formerly inhabited by Ilich Ramirez Sanchez. By the third day, they were gone. At 3 a.m., Wall went out for a last jog. He passed by the old OP one last time. Running down Riyadh Road toward Airport Road, he spotted traffic in front of Carlos the Jackal's apartment building. What the hell was going on, he wondered. It was the middle of the night, hours before dawn. There were a number of vehicles, a few station wagons, and a large truck with the engine running. There were 20 or so policemen. They'd created a perimeter around the building. Waugh recognized a man from photographs he'd viewed during agency intelligence briefings. He was large and had very black skin, recalls Waugh. He wore a crisp white turban and a crisp, clean white robe. There was a large security presence around the man. I realized it was Sudan's number two, Hassan Al-Turabi, in the flesh. Waugh stopped jogging and took cover. He called Santos on the portable radio he kept tied to his body at all times, in case of emergency. I woke him up. I told him to get up and look out the window of the OP. Santos did as instructed. Use the night lens and get some photographs, Waugh said. Use high-speed night film. If Santos could get photographs of Turabi, the CIA would have evidence linking Carlos the Jackal to his state sponsor, Sudan. From where Waugh hid in the bushes, he watched Lana Girard exit the building. She was carrying a suitcase and crying, he recalls. Hassan Al-Turabi comforted her like they were old friends. Lana climbed into the back seat of a police vehicle and was driven away. In the morning, Waugh called Kofor Black to tell him about the new photos. What in hell were you doing outside at 3 a.m.? Kofor asked. Staying fit, boss, Waugh said. At the embassy, Waugh learned what had happened to the Jackal after he was captured. They jabbed him with sodium pentothal, says Waugh. They put a bag over his head and said, start answering questions, or he'd be turned over to Mossad. No one wants to be turned over to Mossad. Carlos the Jackal sang like a bird. According to Billy Waugh, the CIA got the intelligence it hoped for and more. The CIA files on Ilich Ramirez Sanchez remain classified. He was taken to France, where he was tried, convicted, and sentenced by an anti-terrorism court to serve multiple life terms in a French prison. There he remains.